We have no kinsman who is a priest,
said the minister, but his wife interposed. Last night I dreamed of my daughter, Wen Chiao. Perhaps he has a message from her. So Hsuan Tsang was shown in, and when he saw the minister and his wife, he fell weeping to his knees and bowed to them, taking from the folds of his dress a letter. When the minister had read it through, he uttered a piercing cry.
What is it?
The wife asked.
Wife, he said, this is our grandchild, our son-in-law. Chien O was killed by robbers, and my daughter was forced to live with a murderer as his wife. But do not despair. At tomorrow's court I will tell the emperor of this, and he will send soldiers to avenge the death of our son-in-law.
When the king of Tiang heard the story, he fell into a great rage and put 60,000 soldiers at the minister's disposal. They hurried to Chiangchu by forced marches and pitched camp on the north bank of the river. Then he sent a message to the two imperial assessors of Chiangchu, telling them the whole story and asking for their assistance. Before dawn, Liu's house was surrounded. He was woken by the sound of cannon and drums, and before he could collect his wits, he was in his enemy's hands. Minister Yin ordered him to be bound and taken to the place of execution while the army camped outside the walls of the city. When Yin had taken his seat in the governor's residence, he at once sent for Wen Chao. At first she was ashamed to be seen, remembering that she had yielded herself to a stranger, but she was at last persuaded that she had acted under compulsion and had nothing to be ashamed of. Then father and child embraced, weeping, and Hsuan Tsang still wept bitterly. You two have no need to worry any more, said Yin. The culprit has been bound, and it only remains to dispose of him. It so happened that the other bandit, Lai, who had been left in charge of the boat, had recently been arrested. He was first cut to pieces and his head exposed on a stake. But Liu was brought to the exact spot where he had done Chien to death, and in the presence of Yin, Wen Chao, and Hsuan Tsang, he was ripped open, and his heart and liver offered to the soul of Chien O, a written dedication being solemnly burnt. A yaksha who was patrolling the waters brought the dedication in its spirit form to the Dragon King. The dragon at once sent a turtle officer to Chien, saying, Best congratulations. Your wife, child, and father-in-law are all on the bank sacrificing to you. I will now restore your soul to you and let you go. He told a yaksha to escort Chien's body to the surface of the water and there to give him back his soul. After the sacrifice, Wen Chao tried hard to fling herself into the river and was only with difficulty restrained by her son. While the struggle was in progress, a corpse suddenly appeared, floating on the water, and finally rested on the river bank. Craning forward to peer at it, Wen Chao recognized the body as that of her husband, whereupon she burst once more into loud wailing. Everyone pressed forward to look, and in a moment they saw the hands unclasp and the legs stretch. The whole body began to stir, and Chien clambered up onto the bank and sat down, to the intense astonishment of everyone present. Blinking and opening his eyes, Chien saw his wife, father-in-law, and a young priest gathered about him, weeping.
"What are you all doing here?"
he asked.
After you were killed, I bore this son, said Wen Chao, who fortunately found a patron in the abbot of the Golden Mountain Temple.
Then she told him the whole story, adding,
But how did you get back your soul?
It all came of my buying that golden carp and setting it free, he said. For the carp turned out to be a dragon king. Afterwards, when the brigand threw me into the river, I came to no harm, thanks to his protection, and he has just given me back my soul. When the officials of the palace heard the story, they all came to congratulate Chien. The minister Yin then ordered a grand banquet to fete them, and next day he and his troops set out on their homeward march. When they reached the Inn of 10,000 Blossoms, Yin called a halt, and Chieng and his son went to look for the old lady. The night before she had dreamed that a plank of wood blossomed and that magpies were clamouring behind the house. She thought to herself, "Perhaps this means that my grandson is coming." She was just thinking this when Chieng and Hsuan Tsang arrived. After mother and son had embraced and the bill had been paid, they all started off for the capital. At the next court, the minister Yen stepped forward, reported to the emperor what had happened, and recommended that Chien O should be used in some important capacity, commensurate with his great talents. He was accordingly made sub-chancellor of the Grand Secretariat, and assisted the government in the framing of its policies. Hsuan Tsang devoted himself to meditation and religious austerities in the Hung Fu temple. If you do not know how things went on after this, you must listen to what is told in the next chapter. On the banks of the river Qing, there lived two worthies, a fisherman named Chang Hsiao and a woodman named Lai Ting. Neither of them had passed any of the official examinations. They were what is known as lettered countrymen. One day, when they had been to the capital, Lai, with his load of firewood, Chang, with his basket of carp, they went into a wine shop and had a few drinks. Then, somewhat tipsy, they set off for home, rambling, jug in hand, along the banks of the Qing. Reciting song words and linking verses as they went, they reached the place where their ways parted and stood bowing ceremoniously to each other.
"Look after yourself, Brother Lai," said Chang. "If a tiger comes along, I may, as the saying goes, have one friend less in the street." "That's not the way to talk to a friend," said Lai. "It's unlucky to speak of such things. And anyway, you're just as likely to capsize in your boat and get drowned."
"So you say," said Chang. "But as a matter of fact, I should know if anything was going to happen to me. In Westgate Street, there is a fortune teller. Every day I bring him a carp, and he consults the little sticks. He has not been wrong once in 100 times. Today he told me to set my nets to the east of the big bend of the Qing River and to cast my line from the western bank. I shall certainly get a good catch, which I shall sell in the city, and with the money I get we'll pay for another drink and finish our talk."
Now there is a proverb, "What is said on the road is heard in the grass." Ayak Shah, patrolling the river, overheard this conversation and reported it to the Dragon King.
"If he's never once wrong in 100 times, said the Yaksha, "work it out for yourself. It won't be long before our whole watery tribe is extinct."
The Dragon King was for seizing his sword and rushing off at once to slay the soothsayer, but his dragon children and grandchildren, all his fish ministers and fish generals, restrained him, saying, "Your Majesty had better find out first if it's true. If you rush off like this, the clouds will follow you and the rains go at your side. Great damage will be done to the people of Chiang'an, who will complain of you in their prayers, and heaven will intervene. Why don't you make use of your magic powers? Disguise yourself as a scholar and make an investigation on the spot. If anything of this kind is really going on, destroy the fellow at once. If the story is untrue, it would be a pity to slay an innocent man." Arriving at Westgate Street, disguised as his counsellors had suggested, the dragon saw a noisy crowd thronging round someone who was holding forth to them on the conjunctions of planets and stars. The Dragon King pushed through the crowd, and having exchanged civilities with the soothsayer, said he particularly desired to know what the weather was going to be like. The soothsayer handed him a slip on which was written, "Mists hide the treetops, clouds veil the hill. If you want rain tomorrow, you shall have your fill."
"At what hour will it rain, and how much will fall?"
asked the Dragon King. At the hour of the dragon, said the soothsayer, clouds will gather. At the hour of the snake, there will be a peal of thunder. At noon, rain will fall and continue till the hour of the sheep. The total quantity will be 3.048 inches. The Dragon King laughed.
However, it is no laughing matter, he said. If rain comes tomorrow exactly in a quantity and under the circumstances you have described, I shall reward you with 50 weights of gold. But if there is no rain, or any of the particulars given by you fail to come true, I shall come and tear down your shop sign and drive you out of the city, lest you should continue to impose on the ignorant.
Make any conditions you please, said the soothsayer affably. Goodbye for the present. I shall see you again tomorrow, after the rain has fallen.
The dragon returned very agitated to his people, but they only laughed at him.
Your Majesty, they said, is supreme regent of the Eight Rivers. All the rain dragons are under your control. It is for you to decide whether it shall rain or not. Why let yourself be imposed upon by such nonsense? In such a wager as this, the soothsayer hasn't a chance.
Suddenly, a voice in the sky called upon the Dragon King to receive a command from on high. They all looked up and saw a messenger dressed in gold. The king hastily burned incense and tied it himself. When the message was handed to him, it turned out to be an order from the Jade Emperor to go next day with all his thunder and lightning to Chiang'an and give the city a heavy deluge of rain. Detailed instructions followed, coinciding exactly with what had been promised by the soothsayer. The Dragon King was completely overcome by his surprise.
I should never have believed, he gasped, that in the mortal world there could exist such a magician. He has mastered the principles of heaven and earth. There can be no question of winning against him.
Calm yourself, great king, said a fish general. You can easily get the better of him. I've got a little plan that will easily stop his mouth. All you have to do is to make a trifling alteration in the time and quantity of the rain. Then you can claim that his prediction was false and can proceed to pull down his shop sign and drive him out into the street. It's all quite simple. Next day the king summoned the lords of the wind and of thunder, the rain boys and the mother of lightnings, and took them with him to the sky above Chiang'an. He waited till the hour of the snake before spreading the clouds. At noon he thundered. At the hour of the sheep he released the rain. The rain stopped at the hour of the monkey, and there was only 3.04 inches of it. He had altered the times by an hour and the quantity by 8 points. When all was over, he disguised himself again as a scholar and went to the soothsayer's house. Here, without allowing any time for discussion, he smashed the shop sign, brushes, ink, stone, and everything else. The soothsayer sat all the while in his chair, utterly unperturbed. Then, brandishing one of the doorboards that he had wrenched off, the Dragon King bawled,
"You lying quack, you impostor! You've swindled all these people long enough. Your divining is a fraud, and all your talk is lunatic twaddle. You were utterly wrong about the time of the rain, and all the other particulars into which you entered so rashly. Yet there you sit, looking as if the world belonged to you. Clear out this minute, or you shall pay for it with your life."
The soothsayer showed not the slightest sign of perturbation, but on the contrary, threw back his head and laughed.
I am not afraid, he said. It is you, not I, who have committed a mortal offence. You may deceive others, but you can't deceive me. I know quite well that you are not a student, but the dragon of the Ching River in disguise. You have disobeyed the orders of the Jade Emperor, changed heaven's appointed times and measures. There is a special block designed for the execution of dragons, and I fear that is where you will meet your end. Yet you come here and rail at me.
When the dragon heard this, his scales stood on end with fright. The board fell out of his hand, and he flung himself on his knees before the soothsayer.
"Good sir," he cried, "I assure you I was only joking. I had no idea that my harmless imposture could really be taken as an affront to the powers above. I implore you to do what you can for me. If you let me die, my ghost will give you no peace."
"I can't myself do anything for you," said the soothsayer, "but I can give you a hint of how to save yourself. You are to be executed tomorrow at noon by the minister Wei Ching. If you want to escape with your life, you must go at once to the great emperor of Tang, by whom this minister is employed. If the emperor appeals to him to show mercy, you are saved."
The dragon went away, weeping bitterly.
That night, at the hour of the rat, the emperor dreamt that he went out of his palace to walk under the blossoming trees by moonlight. Suddenly someone knelt before him, saying,
"Save me, your majesty, save me."
"Who are you?" asked the emperor. "Of course I'll help you."
"Your majesty," said the dragon king, "is a true dragon. I am but a dragon by karma. I have disobeyed heaven's instructions, and am to be executed by your minister, Wei Ching. I have come to ask you to help me."
"If it is Wei Ching who is to execute you," said the emperor, "I can certainly put things right. You needn't worry." The dragon thanked him profusely and went off. Scanning the ranks of his ministers at court, next morning the emperor noticed that Wei Ching was not in his usual place. "You must get him to come here at once. Keep him occupied all day," he said to one of the other ministers when he heard the emperor's dream. "That is the only way to keep your promise and save the dragon." Meanwhile, Wei Ching, sitting in his house at night, surveying the constellations and burning rare incense, suddenly heard the cry of a crane high up in the sky, and in a moment there alighted a heavenly messenger bearing instructions from the Jade Emperor that Wei Ching was in dream to execute the Dragon King of the Qing River at noon next day. Wei Ching, accordingly, purified himself, tested the sword of his intelligence and the free fling of his soul, and kept away from court. But when the emperor's summons came, he dared not delay, and hastily robing himself, he went back to court at once with the messenger and apologized for his absence. "I am not complaining," said the emperor, and when they had discussed state affairs for a while, he sent for a draughts board and invited Wei Ching to a game of draughts. Just before noon, when there were still a good many pieces on the board, Wei Qing's head suddenly nodded, and he began to snore heavily, and he was evidently fast asleep. The emperor smiled. "No wonder he's tired," thought the emperor, "when one thinks of all the public business he has on his shoulders." And he did not attempt to wake him.
When at last Wei Qing woke up, he was appalled to find that he'd dozed in the imperial presence, and flung himself at the emperor's feet, saying, "I deserve death 1,000 times. I suddenly felt very tired. I don't know why it happened. I beg your majesty to pardon me for this gross disrespect." "Get up," said the emperor. "You've done nothing disrespectful." Then, emptying the remaining pieces off the board, he suggested that they should start a new game. They were just setting the pieces when in rushed two captains carrying a dragon's head dripping with blood. They flung it at the emperor's feet, crying,
"Your majesty, we have heard of seas becoming shallow and rivers running dry, but of such a thing as this we have never heard tell."
"Where does this come from?"
Wei Ching and the emperor exclaimed in chorus.
"To the south of the Thousand Steps Gallery at the top of Cross Street," they said. "It fell from the clouds, and we thought it right to inform you at once."
"What does this mean?"
asked the emperor, turning, much perturbed, to Wei Ching.
"It is the head of the dragon that I killed in dream just now when I fell asleep," he said.
"But while you were asleep," said the emperor, "you never moved hand or foot, nor had you a sword. How can you have beheaded this dragon?"
The emperor was very sad. He had undertaken to save the dragon and failed to keep his promise. At last he
composed himself and gave orders that the dragon's head should be hung in the market as a spectacle for the people of Chiang'an. That evening in his palace he continually thought of how the dragon had begged for his help, and he felt utterly wretched at having failed entirely to protect it from its fate. He worried so much that in the end he began to feel quite ill. At the second watch, a sound of weeping was heard outside the palace gates, and the emperor became more agitated than ever. A moment later there appeared before him the figure of the Dragon King, carrying his gory head in his hand.
"Give me back my life," the head cried. "Yesterday you promised faithfully that you would save me, yet when the time came you sent your minister to cut off my head. Come back with me. I'm going to impeach you before Yama, King of Death."
And he laid hands on the emperor, who tried again and again to shake him off. He tried, too, to cry for help, but the cry stuck in his throat. So violent was his struggle that sweat flowed all over his frame. When at last he came to himself, the apparition had vanished.
"A ghost! A ghost!" he cried, and neither he nor his queens and concubines, in fear and trembling, could sleep a wink for the rest of the night.
At dawn his ministers waited in vain for the emperor to appear at court, and the sun was well up when at last a messenger informed them that the emperor was indisposed, and the court could not be held. News came that the court physician had been summoned, and when he came out of the palace, the waiting courtiers asked him anxiously what kind of sickness it was.
"His Majesty's pulse is irregular," he said. "It misses beats, and then is over-frequent. He talks wildly of seeing a ghost. The pulse showed one intermission to every 10 beats. There is no humour in the 5 entrails. I fear the disease will prove fatal within 7 days.
His verdict caused consternation among the assembled officials. In the midst of the confusion came a message from the emperor summoning Tsu Mao Kung and the other ministers to his bedside. Addressing them in a firm voice, his majesty said, "Wise counselors, from my 19th year I waged war on 4 frontiers, and for years on end took part in fierce campaigns. In all that time I was never once assailed by spirits of the dead. Yet now I have begun to see ghosts."
"In your conquests," said his minister Wai Chiai, "you took countless lives. Why should you begin now to fear ghosts?"
"Believe me or not," said the emperor, "as soon as night comes on, bricks and tiles hurtle about just outside my room, and ghosts or goblins scream in a manner truly terrible. If it were in the daytime, I could make shift to put up with it, but on dark nights it is unendurable."
"Your Majesty need not be disquieted," said the minister Qin Shupeo. "I and my colleague Hu Qinte will tonight mount guard outside the palace gates, and will find out what spirit it is that is haunting you."
The offer was accepted, and the 2 ministers in full armour and axe in hand took up their position outside the palace gates. But dawn came without the slightest sign of any apparition. The emperor had a good night's rest, and in the morning sent handsome rewards to the 2 watchers. The same precaution was taken for several nights in succession with the same result. But the emperor was able to take very little nourishment, and his condition became more and more grave. At the end of this period, the emperor sent for the 2 ministers and said that he could not bear the idea of their being put to this inconvenience any longer. "I shall send for a clever painter," he said, "to make your portraits and fasten them up on each side of the gate. Would not that be a good plan?" The ministers accordingly dressed up in armour and posed for the painter. The portraits were fastened up on the gate, and nothing happened all night. However, when this had gone on for several nights, a great din was suddenly heard at the back gate of the palace. Tiles again hurtled through the air, and in the morning the news came that the emperor had been as badly disturbed as ever. "We seem to have dealt successfully with the front gate," said Hu Tsu Mao Kung. "The best thing would be to get Wei Qiang to guard the back gate." So when night came, Wei Qing donned his armour, and with the sword with which he had beheaded the dragon in his hand, he took his stand outside the back gate. Nothing happened all night. But in the morning, the emperor was much worse. During the day, the empress, despairing of his recovery, summoned the ministers and discussed with them the details of the imperial interment. The emperor himself gave final instructions upon vital points of national policy and named the Prince of Chu as his successor. He was then washed, put into fresh clothing, and lay awaiting his end. Wei Qing now approached the bed and, pulling at the imperial bedclothes, whispered, "Your Majesty, have no anxiety. I have a plan which will ensure that you will yet live many years."
"The sickness has entered the marrow of my bones," said the emperor, "and at the very point of death, how can you hope to save me?"
"I have a letter," said Wei Qing, "which I shall give you to take with you to the realms of death. It is addressed to Tsiu Chiu, one of the judges of the dead."
"I have never heard of him," said the emperor.
"He was a minister of the founder of our dynasty," said Wei Qing, "and rose to be vice president of the board of rites. He was held in great estimation, and when he died, he was put in charge of the archives of the court of death. He often appears to me in dreams, and if you take this letter as an introduction to him, he will certainly oblige me by sending you back."
The emperor took the letter and put it in his sleeve. Then his eyes grew dim, and he died. His wives and his concubines, his heir, and all his ministers mourned for him with exemplary piety, and the body was duly laid in state in the hall of the White Tiger. If you do not know how the emperor came to life again, you must read what is told in the next chapter. Everything was dim and blurred, but it seemed to the emperor that he was standing outside the Tower of the Five Phoenixes. A little way off he saw a groom holding his war charger and motioning to him to come and ride to the hunt. The emperor gladly accepted the suggestion and set off in that direction, but when he had gone some way he suddenly became aware that horse and groom had both vanished. He was in wild country, walking all alone. He was looking about for some path or track when he heard a voice shouting at him, "This way, great emperor of Tiang, this way!" Going in the direction of the voice, he found a man kneeling down and crying, "Forgive me, great king, for having come only this far to meet you." "Who are you?" asked the emperor, "and why did you come out to meet me?"
"About half a month ago," said he, "in the halls of death I came across the dragon of the Qing River, who complained that your majesty first promised to save him and then had him beheaded, and that the senior judge of the dead had sent demons to arrest you and bring you to trial. That is why I expected that you would be coming this way. My name is Cui Chiu, and I was once vice president of the Board of Rites. Now I am an assistant judge at the courts of the dead."
"This is indeed a fortunate meeting," said the emperor, motioning Cui to rise from his knees. "I have a letter for you from my minister, Wei Qing." And he took the letter out of his sleeve. This is what Cui Chiu read. "Your junior, Wei Qing, unworthy of your love, bows his head and salutes his venerable bond brother, Cui. Looking back upon our meetings in old days, I seem to see you before me and hear the sound of your voice. But years have sped since I received the benefit of your advice. At stated times and seasons I make offerings to your soul, but do not know whether you receive them. You have indeed been kind enough to inform me in dreams of your high promotion, but the worlds of light and darkness lie far apart, and we cannot meet face to face. It occurred to me, when His Majesty the Emperor suddenly passed away, that he would certainly come across you at the tribunal of the dead. I beg of you, in remembrance of our friendship while you were alive, to put in a word for His Majesty, in case there is any question of his being allowed to return to life. Thanking you again,
I must now close.
I heard about Wei Qiang killing the dragon in a dream, said Sui Chiu. A remarkable feat. I know that he has been very kind in looking after my descendants. Your Majesty may rest assured that, having received this letter, I shall see to it that Your Majesty returns to the world of light and to your palace.
At this point, two servants carrying a huge umbrella of state with long streamers arrived, crying, "The King of Death requests your presence." The Emperor let them take charge of him, and he soon arrived at a gate, above which was the inscription, "Tribunal of the Realms of Darkness," written in letters of gold. Going in, he came to a street, at the sight of which stood his predecessor, Lai Huan, his elder brother, Lai Qian Qiang, and his deceased younger brother, Lai Yuan Chai. They came forward, crying, "Here is Shi Min." His brothers clutched at him, imploring him to save them. He tried to slip past, but they barred his path. At last, Sui Chiu told a hook-tusked, blue-faced demon to drive them back, and the Emperor was able to proceed. Soon they came to a high, green-tiled platform. There was a tinkle of girdled jades, a waft of strange perfume, and a number of torch-bearers arrived, followed by the 10 judges of the dead, who advanced towards the Emperor, bowing low. He did not dare accept their homage, and stood hesitating.
"We are the kings of the dead in the world of darkness. You are a king of men in the world of light. We and you each have our sphere, and need not stand on overmuch ceremony."
"I have come here to answer for a crime," said the Emperor, "and it is not for me to stand upon my rights as a sovereign of the living." When they had taken their seats in the hall, and the Emperor had been motioned to his proper place as defendant, the first judge addressed him as follows.
"The dragon of the Qing River accuses Your Majesty of having promised to save him, and having then beheaded him. What have you to say?"
"It was with the express intention of saving him," said the Emperor, "that I invited Wei Qiang to play draughts with me. Unfortunately, Wei Qiang fell asleep, and in his dream he executed this dragon. What happened was due to a momentary nervous breakdown which incapacitated my minister, and in any case the dragon was guilty of a mortal offence. I can't see that I am to blame."
"We are quite aware," said the judge, "that even before this dragon was born, it was already entered in the Book of Fate that he was to be beheaded by a human official. But as he made this complaint about you, we were under an obligation to bring Your Majesty here and investigate the charge. We shall now submit him to the action of the Wheel of Incarnation, and he will enter upon a new existence. It only remains to ask Your Majesty to step down and forgive us for the inconvenience to which you have been put."
He then ordered the records to be brought in, that he might see how long the Emperor had still to live. Tsui, whose duty it was to keep the archives, hurried off to the office where they were kept, and taking out the file where the dossiers of all the kings in the world were kept, he turned up that of the King of Tiang, and found that he was destined to die in the 13th year of the period Cheng Quan. He quickly seized a brush and added 3 strokes. Then he presented the papers. The first judge glanced at them and saw that the Emperor was to die in the 33rd year of Cheng Quan.
"How long have you been on the throne?"
he asked. 13 years. said the Emperor.
"That gives you 20 more years to live," said the judge. "There is no need to detain you any further."
Sui and a captain ghost called Chu were detailed to escort him back to life. As he was going out, he turned and asked whether he might feel happy about the various members of his family, or whether any of them was in danger.
"They are all quite safe," said the judge. except your younger sister. It does not look as though she has long to live."
The emperor thanked him and added, "I should very much like to send you a little present of some kind when I get back. How about some melons?"
"We have plenty of western melons and eastern melons,"
said the judge.
"But we are very badly off for southern melons."
"I'll make a point of sending you some," said the emperor. Then, guided by Chu, who led the way with his ghost-guiding banner, and Sui escorting him in the rear, the emperor set off for the realm of light. They crossed the river of death and came presently to the city of the slain. As he entered, the emperor's ears were assailed by a hubbub of clamoring voices. He could clearly distinguish the words, "Lai Shai Min has come." A moment later, a throng of pitiable ghosts, some headless, some with mangled limbs or bodies deformed by the rack, pressed about him, shouting, "Give us back our lives!" He tried to evade them, crying to Tsui for help.
"Those," said Tsui, "are the ghosts of brigands and robbers who were caught and put to death. Here there is no one to receive them, and they are cut off from salvation. They have no money or belongings, and are indeed what is known as pretas, or hungry ghosts. If you gave them some money, you would soon be rid of them."
"I came here empty-handed," said the emperor. "How am I to get money?"
"Among the living," said Sui, "there is one who has credit with us for great sums of silver and gold. You can borrow from him on my guarantee and scatter alms among these ghosts. Then they will let you pass."
"Who is this man?" the emperor asked.
"He is called Xiang Liang," said Sui. "And there are 13 casks of silver and gold to his credit here. You can repay him what you borrow when you get back to life."
So the emperor borrowed silver and gold, and Captain Chu flung it among ghosts. "Divide it fairly between you, and let his majesty pass," Sui cried to them. "When he gets back, he will have a great mass set for you, and you shall all be saved." Setting out again, they came presently to a gate where Sui said, "This is almost the end of your journey. I shall now leave you in the hands of Captain Chu, who will escort you on the remaining stage. Don't forget to celebrate the great mass for the salvation of the souls of the hungry. A king against whom no tongue clamors in the underworld for vengeance will rule long years in peace." He parted from Sui and followed Chu through the gate. At the far side they found a dappled palfrey, ready saddled. Chu helped him to mount it, and in a single short gallop, the emperor came to the banks of the Wei River, which ran to the south of his capital. In the river were two golden carp sporting together and leaping in and out of the waves. The emperor found them delightful to look at, and reining in his horse, he watched them attentively. "There is no time to lose," cried Chu, coming up from behind. "You must press on to the city." But the emperor continued to gaze at the river. Suddenly, with a loud cry, Chu pushed the horse and its rider into the river. Meanwhile, the emperor's family and ministers and all the ladies of court were gathered round the coffin in the hall of the White Tiger, sadly performing the last rites of the imperial mourning. Suddenly there came from within the coffin a stifled cry. "He has drowned me! He has drowned me!" The mourners were so startled that no one dared approach the coffin and see what was amiss. At last the upright Sui, the valiant Qin, and the dauntless Qing Te approached the coffin and, bending over it, said, "If your majesty is in any sort of discomfort, we beg you will tell us about it frankly, but we must ask you not to indulge in any spookeries or ghost tricks, or you will unnerve your family."
"It isn't a question of spookeries or anything of the kind," insisted the minister Wei Qing. "The simple fact of the matter is that his majesty has come back to life. Bring tools at once."
They accordingly prized open the coffin, and there was the emperor sitting inside, still shouting, "He's drowned me. Will no one fish me out?" "Your majesty will soon come to your senses," they said, supporting him on each side. "Your ministers are all here in attendance upon you."
"I was in a very awkward fix just now," said the emperor, opening his eyes. "I had hardly escaped
from the courts of death when I was pushed into the water and almost drowned.
Pray calm yourself, said his ministers,
and tell us what water it was that you were drowning in.
I was on horseback, he said, and had just reached the Wei River when I noticed a pair of fishes playing in the stream. While I was watching them, Captain Chu pushed my horse, and I fell headlong into the river.
Your Majesty is not yet quite in possession of your living senses, said Wei Cheng.
The court physician was hastily summoned and prescribed restorative medicines, and gruel was prepared. After a few doses, the emperor was completely restored and capable of transacting affairs. At next day's court, after pronouncing a general amnesty, the emperor issued an appeal for a volunteer who would undertake to bring melons to the judges of the dead. At the same time, he ordered the treasurer to go with gold and silver to Kaiyai Feng and repay Hsiang Liang. After a few days, a certain Liu Chuan, a man of considerable wealth, answered the appeal with regard to the melons. It appeared that one day his wife, Blue Lotus, was standing at the door of the house when a priest passed by, and she took out her golden hatpin and gave it to him as alms. Liu spoke roughly to her, saying that a woman had no right to be in the front part of the house at all. Blue Lotus, stung to the quick by his reproaches, immediately hanged herself, leaving behind her two little girls, who wept piteously night and day. Liu now began to feel such remorse that he decided to end his life, and he was quite ready to take the melons with him. When he reported to the emperor, he was asked to go to the storerooms, where he was given a pair of southern melons, yellow cash was put into his sleeve, and a dose of poison into his mouth. He arrived at the frontier gates of death, carrying the melons on his head. When the guardian ghost asked him his business, he explained that he was bringing the melons as a present to the judges of the dead from His Majesty the King of China. The guardian hesitated to show him in.
"He is a truthful, reliable fellow, that emperor," said Yama, King of Death.
"That's fine."
He took the melons and asked Liu who he was.
"I am called Liu Chuan," said Liu. "My wife hanged herself, leaving me with two small girls. I decided to do away with myself, and wishing at the same time to do a service to my country, I undertook to bring with me this present of melons which the Emperor of China wishes to give your Majesty as a thank offering."
When Yama and the judges heard this, they sent for the ghost of Blue Lotus, whom the ghostly messengers at once discovered and brought to Liu. Reference to the registers of death showed that both of them were destined to live to a ripe old age. But when Yama ordered them to be taken back to life, the messenger objected that Blue Lotus's spirit had been in the underworld for a considerable time, and he doubted whether the body, which she had left behind, would still be serviceable.
"The Emperor's sister, Jade Bud, is due to die," said Yama. "You had better borrow her body."
So the messenger took the souls of Liu and his wife to the frontiers of the world of death. And if you do not know the manner of their return to life, you must listen to what is told in the next chapter. The gale of dark wind that blew through the gates of death when they were opened carried Liu, his wife, and the demon that escorted them all the way to the city of Chiang'an. Liu's soul was blown straight to the imperial stores, but Blue Lotus's soul was carried to the inner gardens. It happened that at this time the Princess Jade Bud was walking slowly on the green moss under the blossoming trees. The demon escort gave her a shove, and she fell onto the ground. Whereupon he filched her soul and inserted Blue Lotuses in its place. Then he vanished to the realms of death. The princess's attendants, seeing her lying as though dead, rushed into the palace of golden bells, crying, "Our lady the princess has fallen down dead." The empress in turn rushed in consternation to the emperor, who nodded and sighed, saying,
"This does not surprise me. When I asked the judges of death about the prospects of my family, they told me that my sister had not long to live."
When they all went round to the spot where the princess had fallen, they found that she was still breathing faintly. "Raise no cry," commanded the emperor. "We must not disturb her." He then supported the princess's head with his hand, and after a moment announced, "She is coming too." The princess now suddenly rolled over and cried, "Wait for me, husband. I can't keep pace with you."
"Sister," said the emperor, "we are all here."
She raised her head and stared at him.
"Who are you?"
she cried.
"And how dare you lay hands upon me?"
"I am your royal brother, royal sister," he said.
"I haven't got any royal brother,"
she cried.
"And I'm not anyone's royal sister either. I am Blue Lotus, and my husband is Liu Chuan. We are both from the city of Chun Chu. 3 months ago I had words with my husband and hanged myself from the house beam with my sash. My husband followed me to death, bringing some melons as a present to the judges of the dead. Yama took pity on us and sent us back to life. My husband went on ahead, and hurrying after him, I tripped and fell. But that's no reason why you should mishandle me. Here you are, mauling me about, and you didn't even know my name."
"I can't make head or tail of this," said the emperor. "Evidently she has hurt herself and is delirious."
He ordered the court physician to bring medicines and help the princess back to her apartments. Presently it was announced that the melon-bearer had returned, and Liu Chuan was shown in and gave a full report on his mission.
"But what has become of my wife?" he wound up.
"I have no idea."
"Did Yama say anything in particular to her?" asked the emperor.
"He said nothing," replied Liu.
"But I heard a demon officer say that her body would be no good, as she had been dead too long, and Yama said the Princess Jade Bud is due to die. You had better take her body and put Blue Lotus's soul into it."
"I don't know where this princess is to be found. If I did, I
should go and call upon her."
"Why?"
"That explains everything," said the emperor. "You remember how the princess said, 'Husband, wait for me,' and so on? All is now clear."
"Let us send for the princess herself," suggested Wei Qing, "and see what she has to say."
The ladies who went to fetch the princess found her in her rooms, shouting,
"What are you trying to dose me for? This isn't my home. I live in a decent tiled house, not in a sickly yellow place like this that looks as if it had got the jaundice. Let me out! Let me out!"
A number of ladies in waiting and eunuchs caught hold of her and carried her, still shouting and protesting, into the emperor's presence. "Would you recognize your husband?" he asked.
"What a question!" she exclaimed. "We were pledged to one another when we were children, and I have had children by him. How could I fail to know him?"
Liu Chuan was then sent for, and she rushed at him, saying,
"Why ever did you go on ahead like that and not wait for me? I stumbled and fell down. When I came to, I found all these people gathered round me. I'd like to know what it all means."
Liu did not know what to do. The voice was certainly that of his wife, but her appearance was entirely different. The kindly emperor stepped in, ordering that all the princess's toilet boxes, dresses, combs, and what not should be handed over to Liu Chuan, exactly as though he had been giving him his sister in marriage. He also granted Liu permanent exemption from forced labor and sent the pair back to Chun Chu. Meanwhile, the minister, Wei Qiai, went to Kaifeng with a store of silver and gold to pay back the money lent by Xiang Liang. Now, Xiang Liang was a water carrier, and his wife made a living by selling pottery. They only spent on themselves what was necessary to keep them alive. All the rest they gave to priests, or spent on paper cash, which they dedicated and burned. Consequently, though in this world they ranked as pious people but very poor, in the world below they gradually accumulated a very considerable fortune. When Wei Chiai came to the door, laden with silver and gold, Their astonishment knew no bounds. Accompanied as he was by a numerous following of horsemen and coaches, they were reduced to speechless consternation, and throwing themselves onto their knees, they bowed low and long. "Rise!" cried Wei Chai. "I have merely come to repay the money that you were good enough to lend to His Majesty the Emperor."
"We have never lent money to anyone," they stammered, "and cannot possibly accept what does not belong to us."
"I am aware," said he, "that you are poor people, but owing to your constant alms and dedication of paper cash to the spirits of the world below, you have great sums to your credit in that world. Recently, when the Emperor spent 3 days in the realms of death, he had occasion to borrow heavily from your account there, and now I have come to repay the debt."
"It is true," they said, "that we have something to our account in that world, but what proof have we that His Majesty borrowed from us there? We could not dream of accepting."
"The loan," said Wei Chai, "was authorized by Tsui Chiyo, one of the assessors there, and he could bear testimony."
"That's as may be," they said, "but nothing will induce us to accept."
Finding that they were obdurate, Wei Chai sent a report to the Emperor, who remarked on reading it, "Such virtue is indeed rare among the rich," and he issued a rescript that with the money a temple was to be built and a shrine at the side of it dedicated to the Hixiangs. A site was found on ground not required either by the people or the military authorities, to the extent of 50 acres, and when the building was finished, it was called the Hixiang Kuo National Temple, and a great inscription gave an account of its inauguration and the fact that the building of it had been superintended by Wei Chai. This is the great Hixiang Kuo Temple that still stands today. The next thing to think about was the general mass for the dead that the Emperor had promised to celebrate. Priests of particular learning and piety were collected from all over China and asked to sit in solemn congregation and select from among their number one whose outstanding holiness fitted him to take charge of the ceremonies. The choice fell upon the priest Hsuan Tsang, who was brought before the Emperor and presented by the minister Hsiao Yi, and the rest, who said, "We have carried out the august commands, and this is the holy man on whom the choice has fallen. He is called Hsuan Tsang." After reflecting for a while, the Emperor said, "The choice is a good one. I have heard of this priest, and it is certain that he is a man of high virtue and great powers of concentration." And turning to Hsuan Tsang, he said, "I bestow upon you the rank as supreme controller of all priests and all matters of religion throughout the land." And in addition he gave him a cassock of brocade and a golden skullcap, bidding him use his best endeavours. Then he sent him back to his own temple to choose a lucky day for the great ceremony. Hsuan Tsang, when the necessary seats and benches had been made and the music provided, selected 1,200 worthy priests to take part in the ceremony. The third day of the ninth month was found by the astrologers to be favourable, and on that day began the great mass that was to last for 49 days, and was attended by the Emperor and his family, the court, and all the ministers, civil and military. Meanwhile, the Bodhisattva Kuan Yin had been looking everywhere in Chang'an for a priest to fetch the scriptures from India. Hearing that the Emperor Tai Tsung was celebrating a great mass, and that the ceremony was being directed by that river float with whose birth she had herself been connected, who, she asked herself, could be better fitted for that mission than he? And she set out into the streets, taking with her moksha and the treasures that Buddha had given to her. What were these treasures, you ask? They were a magic brocaded cassock and a priest's staff with 9 rings. Apart from these, there were the 3 magic fillets which she left in safekeeping for future use, only taking with her the cassock and staff. Wandering about the streets of Chiang'an was a stupid priest who had failed to be chosen to take part in the mass. Seeing the Bodhisattva, disguised as a shabby priest, barefoot and in rags, holding up this shining cassock as though for sale, he remembered that he still had a few strings of cash upon him, and coming forward he said,
"What would you take for the cassock?"
"The cassock," said Kuan Yin, "is worth 5,000 pounds.
The staff, 2,000.
7,000 pounds for a couple of coarse, low-class articles like that? You must be mad," he said. "Why, if it were guaranteed that the user of them would become immortal, that he would become a living Buddha, they wouldn't fetch that price. Be off with you. I don't want them."
The Bodhisattva said not a word more, but signing to Moksha, went on her way. They had not gone far before they reached the Eastern Flower Gate, where whom should they meet but the minister, Hsiao Yi, just returning from court. His outriders were clearing the streets, but Kuan Yin, so far from removing herself, stood right in the minister's path, holding up the cassock. He reined in his horse, and seeing this dazzling object held up in front of him, he told a servant to ask the price.
"£5,000 for the cassock, and 2,000 for the staff," said Kuan Yin.
"What makes them so expensive?" asked Hsiao.
"The cassock," said Kuan Yin, "would be valuable to some people, and quite the reverse to others. It would cost some people a lot of money, and others none at all." "What does that mean?" asked Hsiao. "The wearer of my cassock," said Kuan Yin, "will not be drowned or poisoned or meet wild beasts upon his way. But that is only if he's a good man. If it gets onto the back of a gluttonous, lustful priest, or one who does not keep his vows, or of a layman who destroys scriptures and speaks evil of Buddha, he will rue the day that he saw this cassock." "But what do you mean," asked Hsiao, "by saying that it would cost some people a lot of money and others none at all?" "To a purchaser who does not reverence Buddha's law and three treasures, the price of the cassock and staff together would be 7,000 pounds, said Kuan Yin. "But a pious and reverent man devoted to our Buddha could have them both for the asking."
Hearing this, Hsiao dismounted and, bowing respectfully,
"Reverend sir," he said, "the emperor of this great land is himself a most devout man, and all his ministers vie with one another in carrying out his behests. At present he is celebrating a great mass, and this cassock might well be worn by the high priest, Hsuan Tsang, who is in charge of the whole ceremony. Let us go to the palace and speak to the emperor about this."
The emperor was delighted at this proposal, and at once he told Hsuan Tsang to put on the cassock and hold the staff in his hand. Then he appointed a retinue to accompany him, and had him led through the city in triumph, for all the world like a successful candidate to the examinations. In the great city of Chiang'an, travelling merchants and tradesmen, princes and nobles, writers and scholars, grown men and young girls, all fought with one another for good places from which to view the procession. A noble priest, a Lohan, come to earth, a living Bodhisattva, they cried in admiration when they saw Hsuan Tsang pass. And the priests in his temple, when he returned, seeing him thus accoutred, could scarcely believe that it was not the Bodhisattva Chitigaba himself who had come to visit them.
Time passed, and now at last came the final ceremonies of the 49th day at which Hsuan Tsang was to deliver the closing sermon. "The great mass closes today," said Kuan Yin to Moksha. "Let us mingle in the throng so that we may see how the ceremonies are conducted and what blessing there is in our gift, and hear what school of Buddhism he preaches."
The great Hsuan Tsang
mounted on a high dais, first read the Sutra on the salvation of the dead, then discussed the collect upon the security of kingdoms, and finally expounded the exhortation to pious works. At this point, Kuan Yin approached the dais and cried in a loud voice,
"Why can't you give us some big vehicle scriptures?"
So far from being put out by this interruption, his Swan Tsang was delighted to hear of other scriptures, and scrambling down from the dais, he saluted his interrupter and said, "Reverend sir, forgive me for not knowing that I had one so learned as you in my audience. It is true that we have none of us any knowledge of the big vehicle, and have only expounded the little vehicle."
"Your little vehicle," said Kuan Yin, "cannot save the souls of the dead, and only leads to general misapprehension and confusion. I have three sections of great vehicle teaching, called the Tripitaka, or Three Baskets. These can carry the souls of the dead to heaven, can save all those that are in trouble, can add immeasurably to life's span, and can deliver those that trust in it from the comings and goings of incarnation."
At this point, one of the ushers rushed to the emperor and announced that two shabby priests had interrupted the master, pulled him down from the dais, and started some nonsensical argument with him. The emperor ordered them to be seized and brought to him. On appearing before the emperor, they did not prostrate themselves or even salute him, but merely asked what he wanted of them.
"Are you not the priest who gave me the cassock the other day?" said the emperor.
"I am," said Kuan Yin.
"You had a perfect right," said the emperor, "to come here and listen to the preaching, eat with the other priests, and go away quietly. But you have no business to interrupt the preaching and disturb the whole proceedings."
"Your preacher," Kuan Yin said, "knows only about the little vehicle, which cannot save souls. We possess the Tripitaka of the big vehicle, which saves the souls of the dead and succours those that are in peril."
The emperor was delighted at this news and asked at once where it was.
"It is in India," said Kuan Yin, "at the temple of the great thunderclap where the Buddha Tathagata dwells."
"Do you know these teachings by heart?" asked the emperor.
"I do," said the bodhisattva.
"Then his Swan Tsang shall retire," said the emperor, "and you shall mount the dais and expound them to us." But instead of doing so, Kuan Yin floated up into the sky and revealed herself in all the glory of her true form, holding the willow spray and the sacred vase, while Moksha stood at her left side holding his staff. The emperor hastened to prostrate himself, and all his ministers knelt down and burned incense, while the audience, priests, nuns, officers, craftsmen, and merchants bowed down, crying, "The Bodhisattva! The Bodhisattva!" The emperor's joy was so great that he forgot his rivers and hills. His ministers in their excitement broke every rule of etiquette, and all the multitude murmured again and again, "Glory be to the great Bodhisattva Kuan Yin!" His Majesty decided to have a picture of the Bodhisattva painted by a skillful artist in full colors. His choice fell upon Wu Teotsu, that genius of the brush, that prodigy of portraiture, that fabulous embodiment of vision and inspiration. It was this painter who afterwards made the portraits of the heroes of the dynasty in the Tower of Rising Smoke. He now wielded his magic brush and rendered every detail of these sacred forms. Presently, the figures began to recede farther and farther into the sky, and finally their golden effulgence could be seen no more. At this point, the emperor dismissed the assembly and declared that the next thing to do was to find a traveller who would go to India and fetch the scriptures.
An inquiry was made in the temple, and Hsuan Tsang immediately came forward, bowing low, and said,
I am a humble cleric, devoid of any capacity, but I am ready to undertake the quest of these scriptures, be the fatigues and difficulties what they may, if by doing so I may promote the security of your majesty's streams and hills.
The emperor was delighted, and raising him from his knees with his royal hand, Reverend sir, he said,
if indeed you are willing to do me this loyal service, undeterred by the length of the journey and all the mountains and rivers that you will have to cross, I will make you my bond brother.
And true to his word, in front of the Buddha image in that temple, he bowed 4 times to Hsuan Tsang and addressed him as holy priest, my brother. Hsuan Tsang, on his side, burning incense before the Buddha, swore to do all that lay in his power to reach India.
And if I do not reach India, and do not bring back the scriptures, may I fall into the nethermost pit of hell, rather than return empty-handed to China.
When Hsuan Tsang rejoined the other priests, they pressed round him, asking whether it was indeed true that he had sworn to go to India.
For I have heard, one of them said, that it is a very long way, and that on the road there are many tigers, panthers, and evil spirits. I fear you will not come back to us alive.
I have taken my oath, said Hsuan Tsang, and I must faithfully fulfil it. I know well enough that the hazards of such a journey are great. And presently he said, my disciples, I may be away for 2 or 3 years, or 5 or 7. If you see the branches of a pine tree at the gate turning eastward, you will know I am coming back. If not, it will mean that I shall never return. Early next day, in the presence of all his ministers, the emperor signed a rescript authorizing Hsuan Tsang's quest, and stamped it with the seal of free passage. The astrologers announced that the posture of the heavens made the day particularly favourable for the start of a long journey. At this point, Hsuan Tsang himself was announced. Brother, said the emperor, I am told that this would be a lucky day for you to start. Here are your travelling papers, and here is the golden bowl for you to collect alms in during your journey. I have chosen 2 followers to go with you, and a horse for you to ride. It only remains for you to start. Hsuan Tsang was ready enough, and taking the emperor's present, set out towards the gates of the city, accompanied by the emperor and a host of officials. When they reached the gates, they found that the priests of the Hung Fu temple were waiting there with a provision of winter and summer clothing. When it had been added to the luggage, the emperor told a servant to bring wine, and raising the cup he asked Hsuan Tsang if he had a byname.
Being a priest, said Hsuan Tsang, I have not thought it proper to assume a byname.
The Bodhisattva mentioned, said the emperor, that the scriptures in India are called the Tripitaka. How would it be if you took Tripitaka as your byname? Hsuan Tsang accepted with thanks. But when he was offered the wine cup, he declined, saying that abstinence from wine was the first rule of priesthood, and that he never took it.
Oh, this is an exceptional occasion, said the emperor, and the wine is not at all strong. Just drink 1 cup to speed you on your journey.
Tripitaka dared not refuse, but just as he was going to drink, the emperor stooped down, and with his royal fingers scooped up a handful of dust and threw it into the cup.
At first, Tripitaka could not make out why he had done this, but the emperor said, laughing,
Tell me, brother, how long do you expect to be away?
I hope, said Tripitaka, to be back in 3 years.
That's a long time, said the emperor, and you have a long way to go. You would do well to drink this cup, for are we not told that a handful of one's country's soil is worth more than 10,000 pounds of foreign gold?
Then Tripitaka understood why the emperor had thrown the dust into the cup, drank it down to the last dregs, and set out upon his way. If you do not know how he fared upon that way, listen to what is told in the next chapter. It was 3 days before the full moon in the 9th month of the 13th year of Cheng Quan, when Tripitaka, seen off by the emperor and all his ministers, left the gates of Chiang An. After a day or two of hard riding, he reached the Temple of the Law Cloud. The abbot and some 500 priests, drawn up in two files, ushered him into the temple. After supper, sitting by lamplight, they discussed questions of religion and the purpose of Tripitaka's quest. Some spoke of how wide the rivers were that he must cross, and how high the mountains that he must climb. Some spoke of the roads being infested by panthers and tigers, some of precipices hard to circumvent, and demons impossible to overcome. Tripitaka said nothing, but only pointed again and again at his own heart. The priests did not understand what he meant, and when at last they asked him to explain, he said, "It is the heart alone that can destroy them. I made a solemn vow, standing before the Buddha's image, to carry through this task, come what may. Now that I have started, I cannot go back till I have reached India, seen Buddha, got the scriptures, and turned the wheel of the law, so that our holy sovereign's great dynasty may forever be secure." "A loyal, a valiant cleric," they all cried in chorus as they escorted his Xuan Zang to his bed. Next morning, Tripitaka rose early, eager to be on his way again. It was now far on into the autumn, and if he had waited till cockcrow, it would have been the fourth watch before he started. A bright moon glistened on the frosty ground as he and his two followers set out. They had not gone 10 leagues when they came to a mountain range. The path they had been following vanished, and the going became excessively difficult. It seemed only too probable that they had missed their way. They were discussing the position when suddenly the ground gave way under their feet, and they fell into a deep pit, the horse floundering along with them. They had hardly recovered from their first astonishment when they heard voices calling, "Seize them! Seize them! Seize them!" And looking up, they saw 50 or 60 ogres crowding round the hole. The three travellers were hauled to the surface, and Tripitaka, when he could summon enough courage to look around, saw a demon king of the most terrifying aspect, who was obviously the leader of the gang. He gave orders that the captives should be bound, and a band of lesser ogres had already trussed them up and were about to prepare them for eating, when there was a bustle outside and someone announced that "My Lord of the Bear Mount and the Steer Hermit had arrived." Looking up, Tripitaka saw a swarthy fellow followed by a great hulking fellow. The demon king hastened to welcome them as they came lurching and swaggering along.
"General Yin," said the other, "you are looking in very fine form. You may congratulate yourself."
"How have you two been getting on?"
asked the demon king.
"Just managing to exist," said the one.
"Just jogging on somehow," said the other.
While they were talking, one of Tripitaka's followers, who had been trussed very tight, screamed with pain. "Where did you find these three?" asked the swarthy fellow.
"I didn't find them," said the demon. "They just came here of their own accord."
The hermit laughed. "May we venture to impose on your hospitality?" he asked.
"If you will do me the favour," said the demon.
"There is more than we should get through at one meal," said the Lord of the Bear Mountain. "How about eating two and keeping one?" The demon accordingly gave orders that the two followers should be carved up at once. The heads, hearts, and livers were to be offered to the guests. He himself bespoke the arms and legs. The other odds and ends were to go to the sundry lesser ogres.
A frightful scrunching ensued, for all the world like a tiger devouring its prey. By the time the meal was over, Tripitaka was almost dead with horror and fright. It was now beginning to grow light, and the two guests retired. Tripitaka was in the depths of despair, and had lost all hope of escaping with his life, when suddenly an old man appeared carrying a heavy staff. Coming forward, he pulled at Tripitaka's ropes, which fell away at the first touch. Then he blew into his face, with the result that Tripitaka suddenly revived, and falling upon his knees, profoundly thanked his rescuer.
"That's all right," said the old man. "Pray get up and tell me, have you lost anything?"
"My two followers," said Tripitaka, "have been devoured by ogres. What has become of my luggage and horse, I have no idea."
"I see a horse over there," said the old man, "and two saddle packs. I don't know whether by any chance they belong to you."
Tripitaka looked in the direction in which the old man was pointing with his staff, and there, sure enough, was the horse, saddle packs and all, quite unharmed.
"What place is this?"
asked Tripitaka, brightening a little.
"And what are
the three ogres that haunt it?"
"It is called the Two-Forked Ridge," said the old man, "and is a place much infested by tigers and wolves. You would have done well to keep clear of it. As for the ogres, the hermit is a buffalo spirit, the lord of Bear Mountain is a bear spirit, and General Yin is a tiger spirit. The other lesser ogres are all animal spirits of one kind and another. The purity of your inner nature made it impossible for them to eat you. Follow me, and I will put you on to the proper path."
Full of gratitude, Tripitaka adjusted the saddle-packs and pulled the horse by its halter, succeeding in getting it out of the hole. When they were back on the right track, Tripitaka tied up the horse at the path side and turned to thank the old man, only to discover that he was already rapidly disappearing into the sky on the back of a white crane. Presently there came fluttering down from the sky a paper strip on which was written, "I am the spirit of the planet Venus. I came to Earth on purpose to rescue you. During the course of your journey, you will at all times enjoy the assistance of spiritual beings who will see to it that you do not succumb to the perils that will beset you on your path." Tripitaka bowed in the direction whence the strip had come, and then set off alone. He travelled over difficult country for half a day, without seeing any sign of human habitation. He was now very hungry, and the road was extremely precipitous. He was at the height of his difficulties when he heard two tigers roaring just ahead of him, and saw behind him several huge serpents twisting and twining. To make matters worse, on his left was some species of deadly scorpion, and on his right a wild beast of unknown species. To cope single-handed with such a situation was clearly impossible, and there was nothing for it but to resign himself to his fate. Soon his horse sank quivering onto its knees and refused to budge. Suddenly a medley of tigers and wolves with other wild and fearful creatures set upon him all together. He would have been utterly lost had there not at this very moment appeared a man with a three-pronged spear in his hand, and bow and arrows at his waist. "Save me! Save me!" cried Tripitaka. The man rushed forward, and throwing aside his spear, raised Tripitaka from his knees. "Do not be afraid," he said. "I am a hunter, and I came out to find a couple of mountain creatures to eat for my supper. You must forgive me for intruding upon you so unceremoniously." Tripitaka thanked the hunter, and explained what brought him to this place. "I live near here," said the hunter, "and spend all my time in dealing with tigers and serpents and the like, so that such creatures are afraid of the sight of me and run away. If you indeed come from the court of Tang, we are fellow countrymen, for the frontier of the empire is a little way beyond here. Do not be afraid, but follow me back to my house, where you and your horse can rest. Tomorrow I will put you on your way." Tripitaka was glad to accept, and set out in company with the hunter.
When they had crossed the neighbouring ridge, there came once more the sound of fierce growling. "That's a mountain cat coming," said the hunter.
"You sit here, and I will catch it for supper."
Tripitaka was again transfixed by fright.
The hunter seized his spear and, striding forward, began to stalk the tiger. Suddenly, a great striped tiger sprang right in his face. Tripitaka, who was entirely unused to watching such dangerous encounters, was once more on the verge of collapse. Man and tiger contended at the foot of the slope for about an hour. At last the creature began to tire, and the hunter was able to dispatch it by a thrust right through the chest. Dragging it away by the ear from the pool of blood in which it lay, the hunter, without showing the slightest concern, hauled it to the road, remarking casually, "Well, this is a bit of luck. Here's meat enough to last you for several days." Tripitaka was lost in admiration.
"Sir," he said, "you are a veritable god of the mountains."
"Well, I think that's going too far," said the hunter. "It was a very simple matter." Then with a spear in one hand and dragging the dead tiger with the other, he set out upon the road, followed by Tripitaka leading the horse. They soon came to a mountain farm. At the gate the hunter let go of the tiger and called to the farmhands to come and carry it inside, skin it, and get it prepared for cooking. "For I have a guest," he said. Then he brought Tripitaka in and presented him to his mother, explaining that he was a priest of great piety who was on a mission to fetch scriptures from India.
"Tomorrow," she said, "is the anniversary of your father's death. Let us ask his reverence to say a mass, recite a scripture or two, and then start off again the next day."
The hunter, though a rough, burly tiger slayer, was very attentive to his mother, and as soon as she made this suggestion, he ordered incense paper to be prepared, and prevailed upon Tripitaka to spend the next day at the farm. It was now getting late, and the farm hands set out tables and brought in several dishes of cooked tiger flesh, which they laid all sizzling in front of their master and his guest. "I must tell you," said Tripitaka, "that I was admitted to the order almost as soon as I left my mother's womb, and have never in my life indulged in meats of this kind." The hunter thought for a while.
"My family," he said at last, "has, on the contrary, for generations past been accustomed to eat meat. So what are we to do? I'm sorry to have asked you to do what your conscience forbids." "There is no need to worry," broke in the hunter's mother. "We can easily make him a vegetarian dish."
And she told her daughter-in-law to boil some rice and make a salad. The hunter, removing himself to some distance, sat down to a meal of tiger's flesh, unseasoned and unsalted, with serpent's flesh, fox flesh, rabbit, and strips of dried venison, served in high-piled dishes. He was just beginning, and had hardly raised his chopsticks, when he saw the Tripitaka, his palms pressed together, was reciting what he took to be some passage from a holy book. Very much taken aback, the hunter dropped his chopsticks and rose to his feet, but after reciting only a few sentences, Tripitaka announced that he was ready to be served.
"That was a very short scripture," said the hunter.
"It wasn't a scripture," said Tripitaka. "I was saying grace."
"You priests certainly have some queer ways," said the hunter. "One would think you could at least take a meal without saying your prayers."
After dinner, the hunter took him to a thatched building at the back of the house. The walls were hung with bows, arrows, slings, and the like, and over a beam hung two fetid, bloody tiger skins. The hunter invited him to take a seat, but Tripitaka was very ill at ease in the presence of these gruesome and forbidding objects, and hurried out of the building. They soon came to a large paddock, where great masses of chrysanthemums piled their gold, and maples blazed their crimson. The hunter called, and 10 fat deer sprang out of the bushes, and, not at all disconcerted by the arrival of human beings, came up, nuzzling and gambling.
"These, no doubt, are creatures that you have tamed," said Tripitaka.
"Yes," said the hunter. "Just as in Chiang'an, people lay up stores of money and farmers lay up stores of grain, so we hunters must always keep a few tame beasts as a provision against dark days.
Immediately after breakfast next day, the whole household assembled, and Tripitaka was asked to begin his recitation. He washed his hands, and, assisted by the hunter, burned incense in front of the house shrine. Then, bowing to the house shrine, he beat on his wooden fish, and after reciting spells for the purification of the mouth and the body, he read a text on the salvation of souls. After this, the hunter asked him to write a prayer slip for the salvation of the dead, and he recited parts of the Diamond Cutter scripture and the scripture of Kuan Yin, each in a clear and loud voice. After the midday meal, he recited chapters from the Lotus scripture and the scripture of Amitabha, and then told the story of the monks washing away their evil karma. As the day drew on, he burned further incense along with paper horses and prayer slips. When all was over, they went to bed. That night the soul of the hunter's father appeared in dream to every member of the household, saying that he had for long been striving in vain to escape from the torments of the lower world. Now, thanks to the prayers and recitations of this pious priest, the evil karma that restrained him was wiped away, and Yama had ordered that he should be reborn as the child of a rich landowner. He asked them to tender his warmest thanks to his benefactor. When the hunter's wife told him of her dream, it turned out that he too had had a similar dream. Presently his mother came along, saying that she had something to tell him. They both burst out laughing when she told them her dream, which was the same as their own. The whole household was then aroused, and all in chorus thronged round him, saying, "Reverend sir, we cannot sufficiently express to you our gratitude. You have saved the soul of our late master."
"I cannot think that anything I have done can deserve such thanks," said Tripitaka.
They told him of the dreams, and he was indeed delighted. They asked him to accept silver, but he absolutely refused. "If you will have the goodness to escort me on the first stage of the journey," he said, "that will be ample recompense." The women hurriedly made ready some dried provisions, and the hunter, taking with him a few servants, all armed with their hunting gear, set out with Tripitaka upon the highway. Mountain scenery of indescribable beauty stretched out before them. Towards noon they came to a gigantic mountain, up which Tripitaka began to clamber with great pains, while the hunter sprang up it as though he had been walking on flat ground. Halfway up, the hunter halted, and turning to Tripitaka, said,
"I fear at this point we must part."
"I entreat you to take me just one stage further," begged Tripitaka.
"Sir," said the hunter, "you do not know. This mountain is called the Mountain of the Two Frontiers. Its east side belongs to our land of Tiang. On the west side lies the land of the Tartars. The wolves and tigers on the far side I have not subjected. Moreover, I have not the right to cross the frontier. You must go on alone."
Tripitaka wrung his hands in despair, clutched at the hunter's sleeve, and wept copiously. At this point, from under the mountain, a stentorian voice crying repeatedly, "The master has come!" Both Tripitaka and the hunter started in great surprise. If you do not know whose voice it was they heard, listen to what is told in the next chapter.